You are listening to a talk given at the Brisbane City Bible Forum. We hope you enjoy the presentation.
All right, my name is Sam. As you can see, I'm Asian. And what you need to know about Asians is most Asians cannot swim. Most Asians are short. I realise I can't see the back half of this room. I should stand on a box, but sorry about that. Most Asians cannot swim, and so most Asians will have a near-death drowning story to give you, usually because they went to a pool party and some well-meaning Aussie friend pushed them into the pool, thinking that, of course, they can swim. Everyone can swim. I remember when I was in primary school, swimming lessons were compulsory, and I was the only kid in my class who could not swim. And the swimming teacher didn't know what to do with me. Up until then, everyone could swim. All she did was tell them to swim. And she didn't know what to do with me because I couldn't swim. So all she used to say was, swim at me, as if that could help me swim. And I'm thinking, if I could swim, I would be doing it. But she would just say, swim. So I remember one time I sunk. I breathed in so much water, I vomited my lunch back up in the pool. And so for the rest of the lesson, my lunch was doing laps around the pool, scaring out the other swimmers. But see, if someone is drowning, there's no point yelling, swim at them, because if they could swim, they would be swimming. And telling Christians to tell your friends about Jesus feels exactly the same, because you think, I will be telling my friends about Jesus if I knew how to do it. And yet every Sunday, every Bible study, the application is really, we should be telling our friends about Jesus. And it just makes us feel guilty and powerless because we're thinking, you know, I want to. It's not that I don't want to. Just no one is showing me how. Someone needs to show me how to tell my friends about Jesus. So what I'm going to do tonight is share maybe four guidelines on how we can tell our friends about Jesus. These are four things that I have found helpful. I'm not saying they're the best ways. I'm not saying these are the only ways. I'm not saying you must do it my way or it's the wrong way. I'm just saying, hey, these are four good ways. You might have better ways. You might have other ways. I'm sure you do. But I'm just going to share four good ways that I have found to tell our friends about Jesus. So four ways. The first one is the longest, this will take us about an hour, then we'll have a break, then we'll have question and answer time. So, four ways to tell our friends about Jesus. The first way is this. We need to get our friends to become their friends. We need to get our friends to become their friends. Well, what do I mean by this? Well, imagine if I got up in front of you right now and said, I've got an amazing story to tell you. Two nights ago, I was in Sydney and my wife and I were kicking back, watching TV, and this UFO landed in our backyard. A green man got out. He told us to come into the UFO. So we did. We went to the UFO and he took us to his home planet, Jupiter. And then we got out. He showed us around Jupiter. We met his family, his friends. We had dinner with them in Jupiter. When it was all over, we jumped back in the UFO and because of the whole space-time continuum thing, we went through a time portal and only 1 second of Earth time went by and we landed back in Sydney. Who here believes me? So in a room of 200 people, only two of you believe me. No one believes my Jupiter story. Let me tell you another amazing story. 2,000 years ago, God sent us his son, Jesus, and I don't know how this works, but he was 100% God and 100% human at the same time. And while he was alive on earth, blind people, he gave them their sight back. There was a dead girl he raised from the dead, and then he died on a cross. And if you believe this, somehow all your sins are taken away. And Jesus didn't stay dead. 3 days later, he rose from the grave, back to life, and now he's in heaven, but because of his spirit, he's everywhere at the same time. And if you trust this and believe this, his spirit is living in you right now, and when you die, your soul will go to be in heaven with Jesus, and one day Jesus will come back in the future, set up a physical kingdom here on earth, and your body will come out of its grave, be reunited with your soul. Who here believes me? Wow! Almost everyone in this room believes that story. Now, as you're thinking this, why are you happy to believe the Jesus story but not the Jupiter story? And as I'm telling the Jesus story, I'm thinking, I'm not even sure I believe this story myself now. And you got to admit, the Jupiter story is a lot more believable than the Jesus story. So why in this room are we mostly happy to believe the Jesus story, but not the Jupiter story? Why? Because of these things called plausibility structures that we already have. Plausibility structures. Pre-programmed, predetermined plausibility structures that will prejudge what we hear. And based on these predetermined, pre-programmed plausibility structures, we prejudge the story and we decide whether we're going to believe it or not. So these plausibility structures will red flag an idea, bah, 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 unbelievable, 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 or green light on an idea, ding, 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 believable, believable, believable. So as I'm telling you the Jupiter story, your pre-programmed, predetermined plausibility structures are red lighting everything I'm saying. I said, hey, 2 nights ago, this UFO landed in our backyard. Your plausibility structures are red flagging everything. Bah, bah, bah. Unbelievable, unbelievable, unbelievable. And then we went to the UFO. We went to the planet Jupiter. We got out and we had dinner there. Your plausibility structures are going, bah, bah, bah. Unbelievable, unbelievable, unbelievable. And then we went through the space-time continuum, and because of the whole time portal thing, only 1 second of Earth time went by. Bum, bum, bum. Unbelievable, unbelievable, unbelievable. But as I'm telling you the Jesus story, your pre-programmed, predetermined plausibility structures are green lighting everything. 2,000 years ago, God sent us his son Jesus, 100% God, 100% human. Bling, 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 believable, believable, believable. And he died on a cross, and you put your trust in this, your sins are taken away. Bling, 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 believable, believable, believable. And after he died, he came back to life 3 days later. Bling, 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 believable, believable, believable. Wow. And now you think, well, where do we get these plausibility structures from? How do we get these pre-programmed, predetermined plausibility structures that prejudge what we hear, and based on that we decide to believe something as either true or false? Where do they come from? They come from 3 main sources. Our plausibility structures come from 3 main sources. Number one, our community, the community that we belong to. Number two, the experiences that we've had, the experiences we've had. And number three, the facts, the data, and the evidence that we think exists to support the story. Community, experience, and the facts, data, and evidence. And out of these three, which one do you think is the most important for determining whether we believe something or not? Community, experience, or facts, data, and evidence? It's community. Facts, data, and evidence are actually very weak in compelling belief. So let's say I said, hey, you know the UFO, it's still in my backyard in Sydney. Who here wants to come catch a plane tonight and see the UFO in my backyard? Anyone? Only five people out of 200 are willing to jump on a plane, because the rest of you think, there's no UFO. What are you talking about? And even the 5 of you who want to come, let's say you came and the UFO was there and you saw it, you touched it, you felt it, you'd be thinking, no, this is an elaborate hoax. There's some other explanation for this. UFOs do not exist. Facts, evidence, and data are very weak in compelling belief, and we easily explain them away. So let's go through it again. Now, the Jupiter story, right now, none of us belong in a community that believes in UFOs. The Jupiter story, right now, none of us have had a personal experience of UFOs. And the Jupiter story, right now, none of us believe there's enough facts, evidence, and data to support the Jupiter story. The Jesus story, right now, most of us here belong in a community that also believes the Jesus story. Right now, most of us have had a personal experience of Jesus in our life, and most of us believe there's enough facts, evidence, and data to support the Jesus story. And out of these three, community is the most important. Whether we like it or not, rightly or wrongly, community is the most important. We have 3 children, and I remember when we had our second son, it took us a long time to work out what to name our second son. And every parent plays the same game. They want to name their kid a name that's not so common, like John, Peter, or David. But they don't want a name so weird and funky like Matthew with 3 T's and a silent Q. They want that name that's just right, just in the middle, not so common, not so weird and funky, just right, so that parents will think, wow, so people will think, wow, what a cool name. They must have really hip, trendy, edgy parents, hey? And so we decide, hey, what do we call him? Let's go Cooper. Cooper. Not common, not weird, not funky. So he named him Cooper. And that year, Cooper was a top 10 name in Australia. See, we belong in a community, whether we know it or not, and subconsciously we do what everyone around us does and we believe what everyone around us believes. Community is the most important in determining beliefs. Now, who here in this room thinks that women have a right to vote? Women should be able to vote. Who here? Hands up, hands up. Everyone. Not everyone. Boy. They warned me about Queensland. Okay, so wow. Okay, but almost everyone in this room, and we're all Bible-believing Christians, we believe women have the right to vote, right? But 100 years ago, had I asked you, none of us would have thought women have a right to vote as Bible-believing Christians. It's a very community-determined belief. And Liechtenstein, only 30 years ago, had a referendum and said women have a right to vote. So it's a very community-determined belief. Who here thinks we have a right to bear weapons? Like, we should be able to come here with concealed weapons. Wow, 3 people. Wow, the rest of you think, hey, I've got a concealed weapon. I'm just not going to let you know right now. But had we done this in America, in a room full of Bible-believing Christians, every hand would have gone up, hey? So it's a very community-determined belief. Who here believes, you know, we have a right to free education, public education? The government should foot the bill. All right, so all the taxpayers have their hands down, all the students have their hands up, I see. Who here thinks we have a right to health, like public health? Government should foot the bill to health. We should have a safety net. Wow, almost. I said majority opinion. Who here thinks motorcyclists should wear helmets? It should be mandatory. It should be compulsory. Oh, okay, wow, almost everyone again. Bible-believing Christians, this is what we believe. Hey, but if we went to America, Bible-believing Christians, who here believes in public health? No one. They go, nah, this is my hard-earned money, my God-given money. I'm not going to give it to someone else who didn't work hard enough. Why should I pay for their health, their education? And then you say, hey, who here believes motorcyclists should wear a helmet? Everyone goes, nah. It's their head. It's their right to choose what to do with their head. And it's not, who am I to tell them to do any otherwise? And besides, I'm not paying for their health care anyway. So they get, so it doesn't matter. But it's a very community-determined belief. Community is very important. Let's say you came to this room tonight and I said, this UFO landed in my backyard last night and we went to the planet Jupiter. Who here believes me? And none of you believe me because I'm the one schmuck who had that happen to him. But let's say you came in tonight and I said, hey, this UFO landed in my backyard. We went to the planet Jupiter. And this half of the room said, yeah! That's exactly what happened to us the other night as well. We went to Jupiter. I thought that was you I saw in Jupiter. I just wasn't sure. I didn't want to raise my hand just in case. That would have been awkward. But wow, the same thing happened to us. This half of the room. Now, how are you guys feeling? So I think, whoa, this story is a bit more believable, isn't it? Now, let's say you come in tonight and say this UFO came, we went to Jupiter, and the whole room said, yeah, the same thing happened. You're the one schmuck where it didn't happen to you. How are you feeling now? You think, wow, this is very believable. And the Bible makes the same claim. Peter says, I've seen Jesus risen from the dead, not just me, but the apostles, and not just the apostles, but 500 other people have seen Jesus risen. So not only is it true, but it's believable. There's a community of believers. Now, let's say you run a church in a small regional town in Queensland, only a few thousand people in this town, and you run a youth group on Friday night, and they're just 3 teenagers who turn up every Friday night to youth group. How do you think your 3 teenage Christians are feeling? Like schmucks, we're the only 3 people in the whole town that believes this. It seems a little bit unbelievable, doesn't it? But once a year, you take your teenage Christians to a big convention where there are thousands of teenagers and they're moshing and they're worshipping Jesus and they love Jesus. Suddenly, as they're in the mosh pit, they're thinking, hey, this is a bit more believable. There are thousands of us out there now. There's a community of believers. So the more if we belong in a community of believers, the story of Jesus is more believable. Now, where am I going with this? when normally when us Christians think, you know what, I'm going to tell my friends about Jesus. You know, I'm sick of this. I'm going to go out. I'm going to tell my friends about Jesus. I need some non-Christian friends, some non-Christian contacts. We go out and we go solo by ourselves to tell our friends about Jesus. So we say, oh, that's it. I'm going to sign up for a soccer team, a book club. I'm going to meet some non-Christians. I'm going to be a Christian influence and I'm going to tell them about Jesus. The problem with that is you join the book club in a room of 20. You're the one person in a room of 20 that believes a story about Jesus. You're the one schmuck. So the story might be true, but just comes across very unbelievable. In a room of 20, you're the one person that's had the personal experience of Jesus. So we go solo. So what we need to do is we need to merge our universes. We need to merge our universes and get our friends to become their friends. Typically, us Christians have two universes of friends. We have a universe of Christian friends, a universe of non-Christian friends. And when our Christian friends go off for a barbecue, we go off with them. When our non-Christians have a barbecue, we go off with our non-Christian friends for a barbecue. When our Christian friends go off to the movies, we go with them to the movies. When our non-Christian friends go off to the movies, we go with them to the movies. What we need to do is merge our universes and get our friends to become their friends. And so when our Christian friends have a barbecue, you say, hey, can I invite some of my work friends along to the barbecue? And when our non-Christian friends go up to the movie, say, hey, can I invite some of my friends along? You bring some of your church friends along. And gradually, bit by bit, your universes will merge. It will take time, but bit by bit, your friends will become their friends. This is exactly what happened to me when I was working as a young doctor. I was sharing hospital accommodation. So I had three non-Christian flatmates. And bit by bit, because all my Christian church friends would come over regularly, they became friends with my Christian friends. And when my Christian friends went out, they would always deliberately invite my non-Christian flatmates. When my non-Christian flatmates went out, I'd always invite my Christian church friends along. And bit by bit, after 1 or 2 years, they became friends. They would naturally hang out together. And after 2 years, my non-Christian friends started to come to our church. And after 2 years, they gave their life to Jesus. And see, one of the ways we can merge our universes is if we're sharing accommodation, deliberately share with non-Christian friends, and your Christian friends will come over and visit. So maybe we're at a stage of life where we're sharing accommodation. If we're at a stage of life where we actually live in a house or apartment, the government actually pay you to offer accommodation to university students. And so you could actually offer accommodation to non-Christian university students and gradually get them to become friends with your friends. So I'm still under the banner of how we have to get our friends to become their friends. And what we can do is gradually merge our universes of friends. When we go out with our non-Christians, bring our Christian friends along. When we go out with our Christian friends, bring our non-Christian friends along and merge our universes, make our two universes become one. Still under get our friends to become their friends, what we also need to do is we need to go to their things before they come to our things. Go to their things before they come to our things. I often get asked by churches to speak at these events where I tell people about Jesus and people bring their non-Christian friends along. And I have a friend called Andrew who organizes a lot of these events. And every time I go speak at these events, I notice Andrew has five non-Christian friends with him. And at each event, he has five different non-Christian friends. And every time I do this, not only are they there, but they are happy to be there. And I can tell by the non-verbal language they are happy to be there. And afterwards, they always come up and tell me how much they've enjoyed the night. So I went to Andrew's wife, Jackie, and I said, Jackie, what is Andrew doing? What is his secret? Every time I come and speak at one of these things, he's got five non-Christian friends, five different friends every time, and they're happy to be here. What is going on? And Jackie says, it's because this is what we do all the time. We always go out together. We're always going to their things. And so when their kids have a school play, we go and watch their kids in the school play. When they have a sports game, we go and watch their sports games. When they have a birthday party, we go to their birthday party. We are always going to their things. So when it's our turn to invite them to something, it's just natural. It's what we do all the time. And it makes it easier for us to invite them to our church events because it's not the one and only thing we're doing. It's not that make or break moment. See, typically our churches say, hey, there's a men's evangelistic breakfast coming up. Invite your non-Christian friends along. And we think, oh, I have to invite my friends to a breakfast. And then your non-Christian friends are thinking, oh, here he comes, here he comes. You know what he's going to do? He's going to want us to come on one of these breakfast things. And you think, when do men do breakfast together anyway? But now there's something you've got to invite your non-Christian friends to. So how awkward is this? But if this is what you do all the time anyway, it will be just one of many things we do. It won't be a make or break thing, and it'll just be natural. So we need to go to their things before they come to our things. So far I've said we need to merge our universes, go to their things before they come to our things. Another thing, still under point one, my wife and I work on what we call the coffee, dinner, gospel sequence. We try and invite people for coffee, and after we've done coffee with them, then we do dinner with them, and after we've done dinner with them a few times, the gospel thing will naturally come up eventually. So what's going on here? Why do we do coffee, dinner, gospel? Several things are going on. So let me explain. A very interesting thing happened in the history of Western philosophy. In the 1600s was a movement called the Enlightenment, and a big figure in the Enlightenment was a guy called Immanuel Kant, German philosopher Immanuel Kant. And Immanuel Kant divided the whole known world into two spheres of knowledge. On this side, he called this the phenomenal world, the phenomenal world. And then on this side, he called this the noumenal world. The phenomenal world is a world of facts, data, and evidence. 1 + 1 = 2. The sky is blue. Water boils at 100 degrees Celsius. This is the phenomenal realm. The noumenal realm is the world of value, ethics, and religion. Value, ethics, and religion. Now, Kant is saying both exist. It's not like there's no ethics, no God. He's saying both exist. It's just that this realm we can access. We can verify with our senses. We can see it. We can touch it. We can feel it. So we know 1 + 1 = 2 with logic. We know the sky is blue with our eyes. We see water boiling at 100 degrees Celsius. Whereas this realm of ethics and values, you know, chocolate is better than strawberry, abortion is right, abortion is wrong, gun control, no gun control, there is a God, there is no God. How do you prove this? How do you verify this? You can't. We have no access to it. So it's this unknowable world. So what this means is in the West, we should, this is the realm of the secular. This has become secular. This has become sacred. This is public for the public sphere. This is the private sphere. If you want to talk about values, ethics, and religion, you do that in private. What are we taught never to talk about at a dinner party? Religion and politics, because that's the noumenal realm. That's the private realm. You don't bring it up in public because you'll cause a fight, because we can't verify it. We will disagree on values, ethics, and religion. And that's why we're always taught to do this sort of conversation. Boy, the weather was hot today, wasn't it? Boy, how blue was the sky? What did you do on the weekend? Because they are safe topics. No one's going to get in a fight. The sky was blue. No, it wasn't. Yeah. What did you do on the weekend? No, you didn't. So we'll never have fights. But here, if you start saying, hey, gun control is good, now you cause a fight. There is a God. No, there is not. Now you're going to have a fight and there's no way to verify it. So the Western world has been divided into a secular, sacred, public, private divide. It's a very Western thing. So let's say I say, hey, tonight, instead of doing this, let's go out in the public main street of Brisbane and I'm going to have an open air prayer meeting. Hey, and I'm going to mention God and Jesus as many times as I can. Who wants to come to this public prayer meeting on the main street of Brisbane, which I will lead, and I'll try and make sure I use the word God and Jesus as much as I can. Who here? No, no one. Okay, a handful of people. But that's because it's public space. You're not meant to do that in public space. It's a main street. Do this in a room like this, in a church. This is private, sacred space. You're very comfortable talking about Jesus here. We did it in the main street of Brisbane. Suddenly, not so comfortable. But it's a very Western thing. So our Chinese grocery stores, they'll have an idol set up, won't they? Because they don't see this public, private, secular, sacred divide. If you catch a taxi with a Muslim driver, you can talk to him about God. He's okay. You go to the news agent and there's a Chinese person behind there, you can talk about God. They don't go, oh, dude, you're violating the sacred, secular divide. You know, they don't do that because they don't have the divide. But in the West, we do. So what the West is, we are actually an unofficial closed country. We're a de facto closed country, rightly or wrongly, whether we like it or not. You've ever wondered why it's so hard to tell our friends about Jesus? It's this. We are a closed country. We're not meant to talk about Jesus in public. That's something we talk about in the privacy of our own home. That's why it's so hard to tell our friends about Jesus. So rightly or wrongly, whether we like it or not, this is the culture we're in. So how can we work with it? How do missionaries work in closed countries? That's how we have to work. One way is coffee, dinner, gospel. What is coffee? Coffee is safe. It's public space. What do you talk about at coffee? You talk about just interest. Boy, how hot was the weather today, hey? What did you do on the weekend? Boy, how blue is the sky? How about them Bulldogs, hey? And so that's what you do over coffee. And coffee is safe because it's public. They're not going to be trapped. They can get up and leave any time they want. And it usually goes for minutes rather than hours. But after you've done coffee a few times with them, now you can say, hey, let's try to do dinner. Dinner is you're slowly crossing the divide because now dinner is private space. It's in your home. It goes for hours rather than minutes. Usually the conversation starts moving from interest to values now around dinner. You know, what are your views on private education, blah, blah, blah. So you slowly move because you can only talk about the sky being blue for so long and you know, how about them Bulldogs, hey? So gradually you start talking about values. And after a while, if you do dinner often enough, gradually our worldviews will be exposed. And this is when you can have natural times to talk about the gospel. And I'll share more about that later. But coffee, dinner, gospel, and it's hard to do because people are so time poor, but if you just keep plugging away, eventually they will come for coffee, eventually they'll come for dinner, eventually they'll come for gospel. All right, so what have I been saying? That is point one, and that's the longest point, but my main point is we need to get our friends to become their friends. I've suggested three ways of doing that. We need to merge our universes of friends. An easy way of doing that is through sharing accommodation or offering accommodation. We also need to go to their things before they come to our things and start thinking about the coffee, dinner, gospel method of getting to know our friends. Get them back to your place for coffee or in a shop for coffee, then get them to your place for dinner, and slowly the conversations will arise where you can talk about the gospel. So that's point number one, get our friends to become their friends. Point number two, we need to learn to listen to their story. We need to learn to listen to their story. Often we think, well, what do I say? What do I say? Well, actually, we let them talk first. We listen to their story. Now, often, I I'm at a party, you know, the music's going, dum, 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 and you're making small talk. I meet someone, hey, what do you do? And I say, hey, and they say, I do engineering. And they say, hey, what do you do? And I used to say, oh, I teach at a Bible college. You know, suddenly the music stops. Everyone turns around. And then, wow, what has happened? Well, think about what's happened. We're making small talk. So we're in the phenomenal realm. What do you do for a living? That's nice and safe. That's like, hey, what you doing the weekend? Boy, how blue was the sky today? And what do you do for a living? Engineering. That's nice and safe. And they reciprocate. What do you do for a living? I teach in a Bible college. It's like I've dragged them kicking and screaming into the numinal sacred realm way before they were ready for it in the relationship. And now both of us are awkward. I'm awkward. They're awkward. And the temptation used to be to just diffuse about, well, how about them Bulldogs lately, hey? Come back over here. But lately, what I've been playing with is, okay, we're here way before we're ready. I say, well, do you have a faith? Do you pray? And these are very safe, non-threatening questions to ask because surveys show that 4 out of 5 Aussies have a faith. 4 out of 5 Aussies believe in a supernatural power. 4 out of 5 Aussies believe in a spiritual realm. 4 out of 5 Aussies believe in life after death. 4 out of 5 Aussies have a faith. It's just that we're in this unofficial closed country where none of us can talk about this. So now that we're here, I'm going to give them permission to talk about it. Do you have a faith? Do you pray? And let's say they're an atheist. atheism is also a faith position. So you ask them, wow, tell me about it. Tell me about your atheism. So I was this did happen to me at a party. I said, well, okay, well, do you have a faith? And she said, yeah, I'm a Buddhist. I go, wow. This is where you get them to tell the story. You're a Buddhist. How did you become a Buddhist? And then she said, well, yeah, I wasn't always a Buddhist. I didn't grow up in a Buddhist family. And so you said, wow, well, tell me how this happened. And then ask them, because you don't know anything about Buddhism, and what they teach in the books is not what they practice. So ask them. You say, wow, so how do you pray? How do you worship? What do you do in the temple? How are you trying to raise your children? Is your partner a Buddhist? How does that work? What are your dreams? What are your plans? What are your ambitions? What is a happy ending for you? You know, like what are you looking for as a Buddhist? So you ask them as many questions as they can. And if you're an atheist, you do the same thing. Wow, you're an atheist. Tell me how this happened. Tell me about the God you don't believe in. And they might say, yeah, I'm an atheist. I grew up in an atheist family. Mum and dad were atheists. Not that that makes me an atheist, but at the age of 16, I had to make a decision for myself. That's the only thing. And you get them talking as long as you can. And now, typically, if you ask someone how their weekend was, they tell what they did on the weekend. What do they need to do next? They need to reciprocate and say, well, what did you do on the weekend? And if you've been able to get them to talk about their story as long as you can, at some stage they will reciprocate. They say, wow, I felt very safe doing that. And that was quite empowering to share something quite deep to me. They will reciprocate and say, well, tell me about your faith. Do you have a faith? And if you let them go for a minute, they'll give you a minute. If you've let them go for 10 minutes, they'll let you go for 10 minutes. And a funny thing happened to me a few months ago. I had to give this very same talk in Adelaide for City Bible Forum. And I'm actually an introvert. I'm a loud introvert. Like, I'm okay in crowds, but I need some quiet time by myself to recharge and recover. So I'm jumping on this plane. It's 5 o'clock. I'm going to be giving this talk in front of a few hundred people in Adelaide. At 7 o'clock, I've got this 2-hour window to get some time by myself. I jump on the plane, and before I could get the earbuds in my ears, which is the international symbol for do not talk to me, before I could get him in, the guy in the seat next to me said, oh, hi, why are you going to Adelaide? I think, oh, no. So, and he said, is it business or play? And I said, oh, it's business. And then one word answer, let's stop there. And then he's silent, awkward. Oh, okay, let's reciprocate. And why are you going to Adelaide? Oh, I'm returning from Sydney. Okay, why were you in Sydney? Business or play? Business, he says. Oh, okay. What did you do in Sydney? He goes, oh, I had to give some talks. Okay, what were your talks on? He says, oh, I had to teach postgraduate doctors about radiology physics. I thought, oh, I can't believe it. 30 years ago, I sat that very same exam. Now we have something in common. Oh, this is going very badly. So he goes, well, what are you talking on? I go, oh. I'm giving talks from the Bible. And then there's just silence. I think, oh, I'm just about to go to Adelaide to share what to do when this happens. I'll be such a hypocrite if I don't do this. Oh, okay. Do you have a faith? And he goes, yes. I grew up in South Africa, and as a teenager, I explored Christianity. I checked out a few churches and youth groups, and that's when I discovered Christianity was just basically a front for hate crimes against gays. So, okay, this is going a different direction. So I said, wow, tell me more. Tell me how this happened. Tell me about your journey. Like, were you always a Christian? Did you grow up in a Christian family? Tell me about these churches. So I got him talking non-stop for 60 minutes. I got him monologuing for 60 minutes. By now, he raised up all his objections against Christianity. They were anti-gay. It was anti-science. All religions were true anyway. And I just got him talking. And at 60 minutes, there was his pause. And I said to him, so, are you wanting to hear a response from me? He goes, yes! So, okay. Well, I said, you've raised these issues. How about I address them one by one? And I did. So he gave me 30 minutes to monologue because I'd given him 60 minutes. I had 30 minutes only because a plane landed at 30 minutes. And then we swapped names and details. I told him what books he could read. He shook my hands afterwards. He said, that was fantastic. That went so quickly, he said. I think, oh, not for me. It didn't. But anyway, so my point is we need to listen to their story. Get them talking. Hear them, understand them, and empathize with them. Feel what they're feeling. Hear them, understand them, empathize with them. Get them telling their story. And at some stage, they will say, well, tell me about your faith. And this could happen at that coffee, dinner, gospel moment, or could be with someone you meet for the first time. And this brings me to our point three. We need to learn to tell our story. Learn to tell our story. So we've got our friends to become their friends. We've listened to their story. Now it's time to tell our story. They say, well, tell me about your faith. And I think what we can do now is we flip it. So, well, how about I tell you how I became a Christian? Because now we have a story. Rather than try to explain Christianity in these propositions and points, which even confuse us, when they say, well, tell me about your faith, so how about I tell you how I became a Christian? And this is when you say, I grew up in a Christian family. Mum and dad were Christians. Not that they made me a Christian, but at the age of 16, I don't make a decision for myself. No, don't say that. Because that is Christian jargon. It's Christian speak. Only Christians know what you're doing. We do it because it's very efficient. It fast tracks the discussion. So now they don't have to hear your story. Everyone goes, yeah, I get how you became a Christian. But it's funny. Every Christian has the same story. So when I used to be at a Bible college lecture, we were going to college mission. Our students would have to get up and share their testimonies. And I used to have this joke. I said, it's almost like if a Christian got up and they were meant to give a testimony, they forgot their testimony. Oh, they go, oh, can I borrow yours? Because we all had exactly the same one. Like there's this template. I think you can download it on the internet. And the problem, it's so abstract. It's not personal. You can use someone else's. So we need to learn how to give a personal story as story. And to do that, let me explain the Greek rule of threes. The Greek rule of threes. See, storytelling isn't just events. It's events through a storytelling grid. And you think, am I allowed to use a grid? Yes, everyone uses a grid. The Bible writers use a grid. So we got to get the events of our life and put it through a storytelling grid. And one of the best storytelling grids is the Greek rule of threes. According to the Greeks, everything worked better in threes. Red, white, blue, blood, sweat, tears. There was an Englishman, Australian, there was an Irishman. Everything works better in threes. And so storytelling works best in threes. And there are three parts to a story. Part one, introduction. Part two, body. Part three, conclusion. Simple as that. Now, at the end of the introduction, and the transitions are very important. So end of part one, introduction. The transition after part one is the mission, the vision. What is the mission? What is the goal? At the end of the introduction, you define the mission, the purpose, the goal. Then you begin the body of the story. And at the end of part two, the transition is what's called the bridge. It comes at the two-thirds mark of the story. It's probably the most important part of the story, the bridge. And then after the transition, the bridge, we go into the third part, the conclusion. And after the conclusion, there's a final ending point called the denouement. The French call it the denouement, the unveiling, the new norm. So the introduction was the original norm. This is where we began. And the denouement is the new norm. This is where we end. This is the new norm where we end. So see how this works in almost all the stories we know. So in romantic comedies, introduction, we meet the boy, we meet the girl. Mission, they need to fall in love and become a couple. So in the body, they gradually get closer and closer together. And just at the two-thirds mark, the boy loses the girl. Then he goes through all this doubt. Do I love her? Do I don't love her? And that's when you have the montage. Because you look back to all that's gone before and he thinks, yes, I do love her. So then you have this make or break moment. He's got to swim an ocean, climb a mountain, catch a train, and he wins a love. And they have this denouement where they're together and they share how much they love each other. That's romantic comedy. Sports movies, introduction. Meet the sports team. mission. Oh, there's a grand final they have to win. So then they have to get this coach. They train. And the two-thirds bridge moment, there's this doubt. Oh, are we good enough? Are we not good enough? Yes, we are. And they have this montage of training. And then they're training. And then ding, 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 ding. The grand final starts. So now in the conclusion, and even that's in rule of threes. Part one, they're up. Part two, they're down. Part three, they win. And then there's the little denouement. James Bond introduction. They chase a bad guy, they catch him, and that's when they realize there's a mission, there's a bigger bad guy out there trying to blow up the world. So now in the body, they try to get the guy, two-thirds bridge moment, they're captured, James and the girl are captured. Why? So the bad guy can montage, reveal all that's been going on before, give away the plot, and now there's a conclusion. Bang! They blow up everything, because in Hollywood, every loose thread is resolved through violence, and there's a denouement, James and the girl together. This is how Christian music works. Christian music, introduction, verse 1, verse 2, body, chorus, verse, chorus. Bridge moment, let's just sing this over and over again. Like, hold it, work em. And then conclusion, chorus. And then denouement, the song leader prays, and then that's what it is. So rule of three, so you're thinking, well, how would this work in my testimony? Well, we have to do the same thing. Part one, introduction. Who are you? Really, who are you? What is your mission? What drives you? What is your existential cry? What fulfills you? What drives you? Who are you? So when I used to teach at Bible college in evangelism, I used to get my students to write a testimony. And this was the hardest part, part one. Who am I? And students would just stare at these blank pieces of paper and go, who am I? Who am I? Where am I going? Who am I? And this is the hardest one. But if you get this bit right, you define the mission, and in the body you show how this God-given drive here, we're using all the wrong ways that will not work because they're not God's way. At the bridge moment is that, aha moment, where you realize the gospel, it's the gospel, it's Jesus I've been looking for. And then the conclusion where you've had to make some real decision to follow Jesus, or share some moment in your life where you've had to really make this real in your life. And then the denouement, what Christian life looks like now. What is the new norm for you? So I share, this is what my testimony could sound like with this grid. Introduction, I'm Sam, I'm Asian, and I'm a high achiever. And then you have to give examples so no one else can use your testimony. For example, in primary school, I was that annoying kid who would stick his hand up and say, Miss, I've finished all the work. I need more work. For example, in high school, if I got 99%, I really sweated on where that 1% went missing. And I got into medicine at Sydney Uni, top 1% of the state. That was my mission. My mission was to be a high achiever, to succeed, to attain. But the problem with being a high achiever is there's always another mountain to climb. And you need trophies more for yourself than for other people, just so you know you've achieved, you've succeeded. And you remember your failures more than your successes. For example, I remember many ward rounds. Well, I went to many ward rounds as a doctor, but the one I do remember is one where they showed an x-ray of my operation having failed. And so as a high achiever, the problem is you're actually deeply, deeply insecure. And it's the insecurity that drives you to achieve. Now, I remember when I was in high school, my chaplain got us to read the Bible systematically. And that's when I realized Jesus was perfect, so I didn't have to be perfect. Yes, I had grown up in a Christian home. Yes, I had known that Jesus died on a cross for me. Yes, I knew my sins were forgiven. Yes, I knew I could be in heaven and God could be my Father. But it was now that I realized Jesus was perfect, so I didn't have to be perfect. And I think this came to this moment in my life where I had to make it real. I had to make it real because I was faced with a decision in my mid-20s where I could either stay being a doctor full-time or I had a choice to go and tell people about Jesus as my living, as my job. Now, being a doctor is the perfect job for an Asian high achiever. Like, bank managers want to get to know you. They want to give you their money. At dinner parties, everyone wants to talk to you. But if you go tell people about Jesus, bank managers do not want to know you. And people at parties do not want to talk to you. But I realize, no, Jesus is perfect, so I don't have to be perfect. I'm somebody because of Jesus. I don't need this to be somebody. I can just be me. I can just tell my friends about Jesus. And now, so the denouement, I've caught up with some of my old doctor friends, and they say they don't recognize who I am now. They say I don't drive like a jerk anymore. I don't dominate conversations at dinner parties anymore. So apparently being a high achiever makes you a very insecure jerk. See, right now, I'm just comfortable with who I am because Jesus is perfect, so I don't have to be perfect. But he loves me so much, he doesn't want to leave me the way I am. So every day is a new project, a new journey with Jesus, where he makes me more and more like him. So that's my testimony. And that will replace the, I grew up in a Christian family, mum and dad were Christians, and I knew about Jesus all my life sort of story, which is fine, which is code for Christians. They know what you're talking about. For non-Christians, okay, you have not gripped them. So we have to engage them. All right, so that's number three. Learn to tell our story as a story. And so that's homework. Go home tonight, stare at a blank page for 1 hour and think, who am I? And there are multiple versions you can give. So that's one version you can give. But just like the gospel writer said, they picked out different emphases from Jesus' life. We can pick out different emphases from our life based on who we're talking to. So we've listened to their story. They've said, well, do you have a faith? And at that point we've said, well, can I tell you about how I became a Christian? And then when we finish that, brings me to point four, we can try to share a story from the Bible. Share a story from the Bible. So after we've told them how we became a Christian, we go, hey, listen. I've heard your story. You've heard my story. How about I share a story from the Bible that really explains why I became a Christian? Because right now you've only heard how I became a Christian. How about I share a story from the Bible that might explain why I've become a Christian? And you just pick your favorite story from the Bible to tell. And it could be a short story, it can be a long story. Doesn't it have to be the exact words of the Bible? Because the exact words of the Bible are in Greek anyway. So you're basically doing your own English translation into your own contemporary English. And you just pick a story that really resonates with you. So the one I love to tell is the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector, because that speaks to high achievers. So I say, well, you've heard my story. Let me just tell you a story from the Bible that really explains why I became a Christian. Jesus, you see, one day he told a story to explain what it's all about. And he said two people went to a temple to pray to get right with God. One guy was a really good guy. He was the high achiever. So he got up and he prayed to God, oh God, I thank you, I'm a good person. I thank you I have achieved. I thank you I'm successful. I don't cheat on my wife. I pay my taxes. I'm generous to charities. I'm not like the bad people around here. But then the other guy, he was a bad, sketchy person. He was a tax collector. He was a trader. He got up and when he went to pray, he just looked down. He couldn't even look up at God. He said, God, I'm full of shame. Have mercy on me. And Jesus said, you know, this guy went home right with God. Not the other guy, this guy went home right with God. So you share a story from the Bible that speaks to you. You can make a short one or a long one. And then you say to them, what did you like about the story? Is there anything you liked about the story? And it's a safe question. They can't get that wrong. No matter what they say, you know, you're going to say, oh, no, you didn't like that. So you just say, what did you like in that story? What do you think you really liked? And that helps them share in a very safe thing. Next thing you ask them is there anything you think people might not understand in the story? Any questions people might have about that story? So you don't say any questions you have, because that's very threatening. But any questions you think people might have about the story? And if they share a question, I reckon just leave the question hanging. Let them feel safe again, that you're not going to cause this into a debate and an argument. Just let them have their questions hanging. Let them feel safe. And then go to a third question now. You say, well, what do you think Jesus is trying to teach us about God or himself in this story? What do you think Jesus is trying to teach us about God himself in this story? And you let them share. And again, I think there's no need to correct them. Just let them feel safe in answering. But it's all about getting them feel safe, because you've unpeeled the layers. You're way into worldview now. Let them feel safe in the worldview area. And then if you can, if it feels natural, you ask another question, say, And what do you think Jesus is trying to say about people in general in this story? What do you think Jesus is saying about people in general? And then, if you can, the final one, what do you think Jesus is telling you in this story? So the sequence is this, 5 questions, and it's not rigid. You don't have to go through all 5, and it's no, oh, you must do it this way, it's wrong. No, no, it's just whatever is coming out naturally. Number 1, what did you like in the story? It's really safe. Number 2, what things do you think people won't understand, or what questions do people have about this story? Number 3, what is Jesus telling us about Jesus or God? Number 4, what is Jesus teaching us about people in general? And then number 4, what do you think, 5, what do you think Jesus telling you, or you could soften it, what do you think Jesus is telling us in this story? And just let the discussion go and let them feel really safe. And, you know, Middle Eastern Asian teaching methods is just to leave statements hanging. So there's real learning in just questioning answer without coming back at them. And they might learn even in just the answering. But it actually lets them feel safe in talking about Jesus. So what have we done tonight? I've suggested some guidelines for telling our friends about Jesus. Number 1, get our friends to become their friends. And remember, I suggested 3 ways. We have to merge our universes. We have to go to their things before they come to our things. Try the coffee, dinner, gospel sequence. That was number 1. Number 2, learn to listen to their story. Number 3, learn to tell our story as story. And number 4, learn to just share a story from the Bible and get them talking about the story from the Bible.